more than 2 months, tens of thousands of India's farmers have taken part in one of the world's largest protests. Back in September, the Indian Parliament passed a set of reforms that fundamentally transform Indian agriculture. And protesters like this one, speaking to the BBC, say that the reforms open up small farmers to exploitation by big corporations.
The corporates will come, they'll pay whatever they want to pay, not the thing the farmer wants to sell on.
And they're scared for their future.
Very scared. Not just for me, for those farmers under 10 acres, they'll die.
Agriculture employs close to half of India's population of 1.3 billion people. That's approximately 650 million people who rely on agriculture. That's twice the population of the entire United States. Yet in India, the sector makes up less than a fifth of the country's GDP. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government says the reforms are necessary for modernization. Spokesperson for Modi's BJP party, Anila Singh, back in December.
And he is trying to improve the lifestyle of all the segments living in our country. And he had pledged that he is going to improve the lifestyle of farmers as well when he became prime minister.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour on Point, an on-the-ground look at the farmers protesting in India. What is driving the upheaval there? And what does it reveal about the world's biggest democracy? Well, we'll begin this hour with journalist Mandakini Gaylot. She's been covering the protests since their inception, and she contributes to France 24, USA Today, Al Jazeera English, and more. She joins us from New Delhi. Mandakini, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
So first of all, I wonder if you could start with what happened at the end of January, I believe January 26th, when it for many people in the rest of the world, the Indian farmers protest really sort of burst onto the world stage with this protest that went into the streets of New Delhi. What happened?
Right, absolutely. Now, these protests have been going on for several months now in the states of Punjab and Haryana. But in late November, farmers started moving towards Delhi and camped out at various sites on the border of the capital. Now, on 26th January, this is really when it becomes a huge international story because India was marking its Republic Day, a day that's usually marked by a military parade presided over by the Prime Minister. And it's a huge event attended by the who's who of India's military and political establishment. Now, the farmers had announced their intention to conduct what they described as a tractor rally, essentially a parade of tractors and trolleys that were going to enter the city once this parade ended. They had secured all the necessary permissions from the Delhi police and other security and law enforcement authorities. A route had been earmarked for them. To do so. Now, this tractor trolley rally, when it began, everything proceeded as per plan. We were on the ground covering it on the borders. There was a lot of excitement as thousands of farmers finally entered the capital to voice their protest. Along the way, a small faction of farmers, it's unclear whether they were farmers, even now we're not sure, broke off from the pre-planned route. And this is where the confusion really began. So you had the police that was trying to secure the city that was already reporting that we have farmers that have veered off the track and we're not sure what's going on. The next thing that we saw is that very close to the Red Fort, mm-hmm. a monument that is in the heart of old Delhi, a monument that sort of stands for India's independence, a monument that was a huge part of the struggle for independence. This monument, a large group of farmers stormed the monument.
Yeah.
Things turned violent, as there was stone throwing. Police claim that farmers threw stones at them. There were images, videos that we saw that confirmed this fact. But overall, the farmers that did reach the Red Fort sort of stayed outside chanting slogans. But all across the city, there were clashes with the police. The Delhi police said that almost 399 personnel were injured. One protester lost his life. The police claim that he lost his life when his tractor overturned. His family claims that he was shot by the police.
Right. So this is really interesting because a little later on, Mandakini, I want to talk to you about how this is being portrayed domestically in India, in the Indian media,
absolutely.
Because that's part of this story here, right? The competing
yes.
narratives. But regardless, I think it's globally accepted that this was a major moment, right? Because, I mean, a rally coming into the streets of the capital, this clash at the Red Fort, and it comes after many months of protests, right? As you started talking about with farmers first in other Indian states and then creating sort of encampments closer to the Indian capital. And you've been to some of those camps. Can you tell us what it's like there?
Absolutely. Now, there are several protest sites on the borders that connect Delhi to several states. Now, the entrance to these protest sites over the last week have been barricaded by the police. So even before you enter any of the sites, you're confronted by a sea of armed police, metal barricades, barbed wire, cement fortifications. And it struck me the other day while I was trying to negotiate this overwhelming display of brute strength that India's government has fortified their capital against farmers, the very bedrock of this agrarian society, the people on whose backs this country is built. But let me just describe one of the main protest sites for you, currently home to tens of thousands of people for over 2 months. It's a 15-kilometer stretch on a national highway that connects New Delhi to the state of Punjab, and it has been taken over by protesters since late November. Now, they came on these large trucks and trolleys that have been parked bumper to bumper and are being used as sleeping quarters. Keep in mind that it's winter, so temperatures often dip to 5 degrees or 2 degrees in the night. There are free kitchens every 100 meters where meals are cooked 24/7, totally free of cost. There are loudspeakers throughout this 15-kilometer stretch that echo the speeches that are being made on the main stage up front. And these are speeches that talk of Indian democracy and its great slide backwards in recent years. Every once in a while, a Sikh sentry with blue robes and grand turbans and ceremonial swords will saunter through the protest site on horseback. And each time they do, people will scream slogans like Inqilab Zindabad, which loosely translated means long live the revolution. Now, it's a slogan handed down to Indians from the generation of freedom fighters like Mahatma Gandhi, who chanted these very words in the face of British colonial batons and guns. So the atmosphere is electric, but remarkably safe. You have local families out with their children, almost as if this is a country fair. They come to eat, to talk, to sing patriotic songs. And as a female reporter in a country that can sometimes be unkind to women, I have felt very safe at these camps. It's really an extraordinary site of resistance, of peaceful resistance of the kind that Mahatma Gandhi pioneered.
You know, it's so fascinating. I think much of the rest of the world can't fully come to terms with anything that happens in India because it's so vast, right? It's a vast nation. And just hearing you say that one encampment takes up a 15-kilometer stretch, you said?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Just one.
just one of how many? So actually, let me rephrase that. Is there, can we estimate how many farmers have been involved in these protests so far?
Well, it's always difficult to do that because the records can be so unreliable. But if I was to eyeball it, I've been at all the sites, and I would say tens and thousands of farmers are in on the borders of the Indian capital. And then, of course, there are hundreds of thousands in the countryside who are joining the protests with each passing day.
Okay.
So a lot of people.
So, I mean, in a few minutes, we're going to talk in detail about exactly what they are protesting.
Yes.
But Mandakini, can you tell us, is there a sense about how long these tens of thousands, potentially more, farmers are intend to continue their protest against these proposed agricultural reforms in India?
This is what's so remarkable to me, because when the farmers arrived in late November, and even though they said they're not going to leave as long as the government does not repeal these laws, it was hard to see how they were going to manage that, because how do you live on a national highway and for how long? But now we've heard leadership, the leaders of these protests, say things like, well, we're not going anywhere at least till October 2nd, which is famously Mahatma Gandhi's birth anniversary. And the only way that they will move before that date, they say, is if the government were to totally and entirely repeal these three laws that they're protesting against. There were negotiations between the farmers and the government that sort of broke down after what happened on January 26th. So as of now, we expect that these farmers will be around for the next few months, the next 6 months maybe.
Wow. Okay. So this hour we are talking about what could be one of the world's largest protests, ongoing protests that's happening in India over agricultural reforms there. When we come back, we'll hear more specifically about what those reforms are, why they may cut so deep in India, and why the Modi government says they're absolutely necessary for the world's largest democracy. So we'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this hour we are trying to understand the massive ongoing protests that are happening in India over agriculture reform. Indian farmers there are participating and have been for several months in what might be the world's largest ongoing protest. We're going to learn a little bit more about what these reforms are that the Indian farmers are pushing back against. There's a potent brew going on there in India with reform, protest, rising inequality. Seems familiar, actually, world round, but it's spilling over now in India. So first of all, let's listen to a little bit of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi speaking about the agricultural reforms back in December.
Reforms bahut zaruri hain.
And Prime Minister Modi there saying, reforms are needed for development. Reforms are very much needed for a new order and to give new facilities. We cannot build the next century with the laws of the previous century. Some laws that used to be good in the past century have become a burden in the present century. Reforms should be a continuous process. Well, these protests, as we said, have been going on for quite some time. Here's a farmer speaking with the BBC back in December.
Farmer will become helpless, right? The whole control of the farming will go into the big corporate's hands. Most of the people's livelihood in this country is based on the agriculture. That's why people are scared that if they will control this food market, where they will buy our crop at whatever price they want, and they will sell at whatever price they want.
Well, we're joined today by Mandakini Gehlot. She's an independent journalist based in New Delhi. She's been covering the protest for many months and contributes to France 24, USA Today, Al Jazeera English, and more. And also joining us now is Vikas Raval, Professor of Agricultural Economics at Jawaharlal Nehru University. Professor Raval, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meena.
So you heard there the clip we played of Prime Minister Modi talking about changes needed, fundamental changes needed from the last century to this one. So what's the basic challenge his government is trying to address with Indian agriculture?
Let me explain what the basic problem Indian agriculture faces. India's agriculture has been facing a crisis now for quite some time, for at least a couple of decades. It's not been uniform. There have been ups and downs. It's not uniform across regions. It's not uniform across classes. But agriculture has been in trouble. Now, to understand what the problem is, we need to really look at two sides of agriculture. The production side, that is the cost of production, and what prices farmers get for their produce. Now, over the last two decades, because of progressive withdrawal of public support, the prices of key inputs in agriculture have shot up quite drastically. Mm. Whether it's fertilizers or diesel or seeds or, you know, electricity, a whole range of services and extension services, obtaining new technology, pesticides, everything has been deregulated. The nature of state support has shifted in such a way that there is an increased burden on farmers, which has meant that the cost of production for farmers is really shot up.
I see.
On the other hand, with trade liberalization, there is the low global prices of food have put a downward pressure on the prices that farmers get in the open market.
Uh-huh.
Now, this has meant that the systems of government's procurement, government procures grain for rice and wheat. And these are two major food commodities produced in India. Something like one third of these commodities are procured by the government. But this procurement has become very critical because this procurement happens at a slightly higher price. Yeah.
So can I just jump in here just to clarify for listeners?
Yes.
So this is a key part. You're describing in the Indian agricultural sector there.
Yes.
You said about a third of the crops grown by these farmers basically are purchased by the government of India.
A third of rice and wheat are purchased by the government.
Okay.
Nothing else.
Rice and wheat.
Purchased.
Okay. Purchased by the government, but a third and at a higher price than global prices.
That's right. And that is critical for farmers to earn some incomes. It's only farmers who can sell their produce to the government that they make some income from agriculture. Most other farmers have been incurring losses in agriculture.
And so,
because of the problems that I just mentioned,
the market liberalization and the removal of government support, which is increasing the costs, the input cost for farmers. So,
that's right.
So one of the key reforms that the Modi government is putting into place is what, the elimination of the government purchase of rice and wheat.
What they're doing is they're undermining the system of what are called regulated markets where this procurement happens. The locations where the procurement happens are being undermined. They are opening up agricultural market outside these state regulated markets. So agricultural produce can be sold outside, and the new law gives tax benefits for purchasing outside the market. So basically you're providing incentive for agricultural marketing to move outside the regulated market. The regulated markets are where the state procurement happens, and basically farmers fear that the entire system will collapse if the marketing moves out.
I see. Because those guaranteed prices will be gone, essentially,
will
right?
Will be gone if regulated markets disappear.
Okay, so let's listen to a little bit about how Modi's government is talking about their desire to liberalize or modernize the Indian agricultural section. Because, of course, they're looking at it in part as a key section of of India's entire economy that the Modi government seems to be saying is underperforming. So, for example, here's Anila Singh, again, spokesperson for the BJP, telling Al Jazeera, the Al Jazeera program up front back in December, that some of the supporters of the protests, those very farmers, have actually held back India's agriculture sector.
Almost 60% of workforce is in farm sector. And the participation in GDP is only 15 to 16%. This is the reason. They do not want that people engaged in farming sector, they should get more option. They do not want that new technologies should be introduced in this sector. They don't want that people should go and sell their produce directly to whom they want to. Why?
So, Professor Raval, there's a lot, actually, in what Anila Singh just said there. First of all, explain to us a little bit about what seems to be that disconnect with, you know, more than half of Indians being part of the agricultural sector, but GDP coming out of that sector only roughly 15 to 16%. I mean, when we say half of Indians, that's 650 million people, at least. Why that disconnect?
Well, you see, the decline of agriculture share in GDP is natural. It happens in every country that's developing. Mm. The problem in the Indian context is that while the share of agriculture in GDP has fallen, the workforce has not been absorbed outside agriculture. Your manufacturing sector has been underperforming for several decades. Your services sector growth has been such that it does not absorb, it does not provide employment. So the problem is that a lot of workforce that's employed in agriculture is essentially in agriculture because they don't get any work outside agriculture. So that's a larger structural problem that the Indian economy faces. And the problem is not that agriculture is not absorbing them. The problem is that non-agricultural sectors are not absorbing them. So the problem is quite different from what Anila was saying.
Well, so that's really interesting because I would say that American listeners hearing this might say there's shades of similarity here, that when the United States has had and has sectors that are contracting or modernizing, the country hasn't done a great job in helping those workers move to new place, to new sectors, to new kinds of work. But Mandakini, let me turn back to you here for a moment. Because the other thing that Ms. Singh does there in that clip is, I'm curious about the way in which she talks about these farmers, right? Because you heard her say that these are, you know, people who don't want to have new options. They don't want to go sell their produce directly to independent buyers. They don't want to use more technology. I mean, is there some kind of caste or class divide being played out or laid bare here as well?
Well, absolutely, because so much of farming happens in the countryside where the educational infrastructure is not up to the mark. So the schools that you have, government schools, our government provides right to free education. Well, don't always provide the standard of education that you could get at a private school in a city. Healthcare is not up to the mark. Farmers, as we've heard Professor Raval describe, have seen their incomes decline over the years. So there's definitely a massive class divide, for sure. I wouldn't say there's so much a caste divide because you have farmers across religion, across caste, but class divide, for sure. And this is what farmers are, you know, the rising inequality that you spoke of at the beginning of the show. Mm-hmm. This is part of the reason why all these farmers are out in the streets. They look at the capital around them. They look at people who have so much, and they know that they grow the food that we eat in the cities, and they wonder why they don't have as much.
Right. Now, so, Professor, sorry, Mandakini, I didn't mean to interrupt you there,
no
but Professor Raval, also, I think we should clarify something. Because, again, speaking to an American audience here, yes, there are still small farmers in the United States, but also there are many large farmers yes. as well. Is it similar there in India? Because I think as I've been reading and learning here, really, are we talking about hundreds of millions of small farmers there?
Yes, Meghna, I think the order of magnitude is very, very different. The average size of land in India is, I think, 0.6 hectares per family, per household. In the US, it's, I think, 600 hectares. Mm. So that's the difference that we're talking about. As per the official statistics, 87% of Indian farmers have less than 2 hectares of land each. So we are talking of really tiny farmers, and these farmers get such low incomes that they barely—they're starving. So you're talking of agriculture that starves its producer. So we are talking of a scale that's very, very different, which also means that Indian farmers cannot in a trade liberalized economy cannot compete with farmers in countries like the US. A US farmer, if the family gets let's say 10% profit over production, given the scale of production, is going to have a reasonable income. An Indian farmer, if given that you have just a hectare or two of land with 10% return over production over your cost, you would starve. So in that kind of different scales of production, competition simply not possible. Now, this in the past would have been helped because of public support. Now that public support is gone.
Okay, so we clarify something. You said given the scale of production, small scale you're talking about, competition isn't possible?
Yes. Because, so as I explained, a 10% return, if you have 600 hectares of land, in absolute amount becomes large. If 10% return, if you only have 2 hectares of land, is just too little for you to survive on.
I see. So that margin isn't big
margin,
enough.
The same margin does not work.
Okay, so briefly then, we talked about one of the major set of reforms there, the removal of those government-run markets for key crops. What are the other, briefly, quickly, the other two major reforms that the Modi government wants to put into place or has put into place?
So the second law is about contract farming, which allows companies to enter directly into contracts with farmers for providing the agricultural produce, and it's a law which essentially provides a completely deregulated environment to the companies. So the companies can enter directly into the contracts with farmers with no regulation whatsoever from the state. Not only that, in cases of disputes, farmers are not even allowed to go to the civil courts for settlement of those disputes. So the entire law provides an extremely deregulated environment in which companies can enter into contracts with farmers. The third law is the Essential Commodities Amendment Act, which essentially has removed regulatory powers that government had on stocking by private traders. Big private agribusiness companies, big private traders can hoard large quantities of produce to sway the market prices. And in the past, government had regulatory powers on such hoarding. And those regulatory powers have been removed.
I see.
Between the three laws, starting from production through contract farming, marketing through the marketing reform law, and the Essential Commodities Act, you've essentially deregulated the entire supply chain of agriculture from production to what goes to the consumer.
The entire supply chain. Mandakini, have Indian farmers ever experienced such a fast-moving set of reforms before?
I'm not actually sure. Okay. Professor Rawal might be the one to answer that one.
Meghna, you know, in as per the Indian constitution, such reforms can actually be made only by the state governments. It's the first time that a national government has introduced such sweeping reforms in agriculture. The constitution has, there's been a reinterpretation of a particular provision in the constitution for the central government to do it. Normally in the past, parliament has never passed such laws related to agriculture. These laws are meant to be passed by state assemblies. So this is really an unusual situation.
It sounds like it's almost unprecedented, though, in modern India.
It is.
Okay. Well, we are talking this hour about the ongoing farmers' protests in India, the world's largest ongoing protest right now. And as you've been hearing, it's in response to sweeping reforms being put into place by the government of Narendra Modi. We'll talk a lot more about why farmers are saying these are existential reforms in their view when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about how we talk about COVID, essentially the whole world of risk communication and whether experts, policymakers, and the media have done a good job for people when it comes to accurately communicating what the risks of a global pandemic like COVID are. So we want to hear from you. At the beginning of the pandemic, did you feel like you were here getting enough reliable information about this new disease? And what about now? Do you think the media is covering it in the right way? Do you think politicians, when they talk about COVID, are helping you make good decisions? How essentially do you judge what acceptable risk when it comes to a pandemic is in your life? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about the world's largest ongoing protest that's happening in India right now. Indian farmers, millions of them, are protesting against sweeping agricultural reforms that are being put into place by the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The Modi government says they're absolutely essential to modernize the agriculture sector in India. Indian farmers, most of them, and again, we're talking about hundreds of millions of people who are small farmers, say it could cost them not only their livelihoods, but their lives. For example, here's activist P.P. Kapoor, who spoke with Reuters last week while sitting in the middle of a street with fellow protesters. And Kapoor telling Reuters, the Modi government, under the pressure of big corporations like that of Ambani and Adani, have brought these three farming laws. Our demand is that these laws be repealed because it's not just bad for the farmers. It's harmful for the 1.3 billion people of our country, whether they are farmers or factory workers or daily wage laborers or small businessmen. And here is Jasbir Singh of the farming village Kandala in Punjab talking to Sky News last week. And Singh saying, repeal the laws. We all have to die someday. It's okay if we have to now. It's as if we are already dead. We will not come back until the laws are removed. Professor Vikas Raval, help us understand why the farmers are seeing this as a life and death situation for them. Because as far as I understand, the Modi government has said it won't drop minimum price supports for key crops. So why is this an existential moment in the eyes of the farmers?
You see, there are two things. One is you have to understand that farming has been in this crisis for a while now. So, you know, they've been in terrible economic distress for quite some time. The second thing is that when you say that the system of minimum support price will continue, that really does not mean very much, because government sets minimum support price for 23 crops, but it procures only rice and wheat. It buys only rice and wheat. Now, unless you back the system of minimum support price with a system of making that a guarantee, that is, you have a system which would ensure that farmers would get that price, it really does not help announcing a price. So saying that we'll announce a price really does not do very much, unless you say, what will you do to ensure that farmers get that price?
Right. Well, Mandakini Gehlot, let's step back here for a moment, because I think it's important to understand sort of the political and cultural importance of farmers in India, right? Because I think it'll sort of resonate here with Americans, because farmers are quite a potent cultural force in India. I mean, they were central to the Green Revolution in the subcontinent in the 70s and 80s when India became very proud that it was like able to feed itself through massive growth in agriculture. Is that not true?
Absolutely. Farmers, to put it simply, you could describe them as the working class of India, the blue-collar workers that are so admired in the United States, for example. That's for Indians, that's the farmers. 50% of the population is employed in the agriculture sector in one way or the other. But they've also contributed politically. They're a politically influential group in this country, particularly in what we describe as the Hindi heartland, or a group of North Indian states that we've now seen join these protests. These are people who have great faith in the ballot box, and they have exercised that power over and over again over the course of India's independent history. So farmers are the bedrock of Indian society in many ways, but also so politically influential. And this is a fact that they themselves are aware of, that for a politician or a political party to do well in an Indian election, in a state election, they have to absolutely carry the farmers with them. And because they're aware of this fact, they know that this is a protest that will sort of draw support from different corners of the country. Now, I just want to say, I feel like I've been on the protest beat for about a year. This isn't even the first protest I'm covering. This began over a year ago with the Citizenship Amendment Act, when we saw Muslims take to the streets and students. Now, it was far easier for government supporters to demonize Muslims or students as anti-national, as terrorist sympathizers. It's a lot harder to do that with farmers.
I see.
So this is a very interesting standoff. And as a reporter, as an Indian, I'm very keen to see how this impacts the government.
Right. I mean, so India itself has been undergoing such profound change, right, over the past several decades. Rapid urbanization, growing inequality, as you talked about, growth in the service and tech sectors, not the same growth as we've been discussing in the agricultural sector. But yet we're still talking about 650 million people, at least. I mean, that's literally twice the size of the entire population of the United States, right? And where in recent elections has their political support fallen? I mean, are these BJP voters? Is it possible to even characterize them as voting for one Indian party or not?
It's not possible to characterize them as voting for just any single Indian party, but a lot of these farmers who are at these protest sites have voted for the BJP in 2019. Before that, when Prime Minister Modi was first elected in 2014, many of them that I've spoken to, very frankly and openly, say that we have supported the BJP. In fact, there are large gatherings of farmers happening in the countryside along with these protests. These are called Mahapanchayats, and the easiest way to describe them would be they're sort of like town halls, but on a much grander scale. And in these Mahapanchayats or town halls, farmers have been saying things like supporting the BJP was one of our greatest mistakes. We've sort of brought the axe down on ourselves by doing that. There are, of course, opposition parties that are kind of seizing this moment and conducting rallies in various states, particularly Uttar Pradesh, which is India's most densely populated state, which will go to election in 2022. And in this state, opposition leaders are definitely seizing on this farmers' protest movement to tell people that there are other options when you go to the election the next time round, and let's forget all this Hindu-Muslim business and come together as farmers. So it's very hard to do, to bring this vast group together for any one party or against any one party.
Right.
But a very important moment indeed.
Okay, so Professor Rawal, let me turn back to you here, because I think it behooves us to remember that really India has only been an independent democracy since 1947, right? I mean, it's still, while vast, it's still young as a democracy. I think the lingering effects of colonialism and various attempts at reform, internal conflict in India, these are all part of this moment right now. And yet I come back to what you said earlier, that agriculture had already been hurting prior to these protests. And the Modi government would say then that makes these reforms even more essential, that perhaps some temporary disruption is necessary to open up the Indian agricultural sector to growth that would then hopefully help those very same farmers in the near future. But if it's not these set of reforms, then what would actually assist farmers in the modern agricultural market?
Meghna, I think what you need is actually to step up public investment. Mm. You need to step up public investment. You need to rationalize the system of public support of various kinds. You need to bring down the cost of production so that there is greater alignment in what would be reasonable prices for farmers, prices that would give farmers reasonable returns, and what is prevailing in the open market. So you need to bring an alignment in the output prices, and you can do that only by bringing down the cost, which would mean step up public investment. Also, you need to understand, if you want greater private investment in downstream supply chain, it can only happen with making greater public investment at the first step. Mm. So you need to set up more regulated agricultural markets with better infrastructure, make investment in those so that further investment in agro-processing and in supply chains and in rest of the activities is done by the private sector.
I see.
Withdrawing public support in the basic marketing infrastructure would actually destroy the supply chains.
So there are indeed some universal truths here, right? Like transforming a market without stepping up public investment upstream is something I think that we can all reflect on in various sectors in virtually every country around the world. That is absolutely fascinating. Now, we've just got a couple of minutes here left here, and I do want to focus a little bit go ahead, Professor Rawal.
If you just give me half a minute, you know, you were talking about culture.
Yeah.
There's one aspect of it that I would like to mention, and your listeners may be interested. These protests have been accompanied by an incredible production of music around them. I maintain an archive of music, which now has 943 songs that have been produced over the last few months in solidarity with this struggle alone.
Wow.
So it's really quite remarkable the kind of cultural production that has taken place around these protests. It's really quite remarkable.
Okay. Well, so this is a very deep cultural moment, which is why I want to just focus for the last few minutes on how the Modi government is responding to it. So we spoke with Hartosh Singhbal, a political editor at an investigative magazine called The Caravan in India. And their editors and publisher are now facing sedition charges in India for some of the tweets they posted following that protest that we talked about earlier that happened on Republic Day in January.
According to eyewitnesses, Navreet Singh had been shot at and died at such and such place at roughly this time. This was the first tweet we had put out. We put out more details of the eyewitness, etc., who it was, police coming to the spot, looking around, finally taking CCTV from a nearby building.
And within days, the caravan's official Twitter account was among 250 handles suspended on the orders of the Indian government.
The parallel, given the kind of work Caravan does, would be that Twitter would suddenly take down the account of any prominent newspaper or magazine in the US or UK or Europe because of a tweet that had relied on eyewitness testimony.
And Bal says the actions against the Caravan, as well as the arrest of a contributor to his magazine, send a clear message.
Caravan is maybe among the handful of outlets left in the country today that are actually scrutinizing the government in a way that the media is supposed to scrutinize it. So I think the message is quite clear that whatever remains of the media, which continues to do the job that the media should, is now under assault in every which possible way.
That's Hartosh Singhbal, a political editor at The Caravan, an Indian investigative magazine. Mandakini, we only have 2 minutes left here. I'm wondering if you could help us understand, how is Modi's government responding to these massive protests and how the world is paying attention to it?
Absolutely. First of all of this round of protests are being recorded and reported through the lens of an extremely partisan media. In recent years now, Indian news outlets, particularly the television networks, have taken an increasingly conservative turn. Supporters of Prime Minister Modi and his governing Hindu nationalist party, the BJP, often brand critical voices as anti-national or terrorist sympathizers, as though supporting the current government equates with patriotism. And this is something we've seen happen with this round of protests too. Protesters have been branded as anti-nationals. But surprisingly, the crackdown on media has been a lot more blatant this time. Now, we just heard Hartosh. I like to think of Caravan magazine as a small group of rebels who are still keeping the flame of independent media alive in this country. But their reporter was arrested merely for doing his job, for going to the site and reporting what he saw, and slapped with a sedition law that was widely used by, again, the British colonial government against people like Mahatma Gandhi. So these are outdated laws. And I think the need of the hour is first to change these laws while we're talking about reform in the agriculture sector. I think we also need to lose some of these colonial laws. So the government's really cracked down on journalists. They've responded very harshly to people like Rihanna, who tweeted in support, acting like Rihanna is a country.
Right.
So, huge crackdown.
Oh, fascinating. Well, Mandakini Gehlot, independent journalist based in New Delhi, contributor to France 24, USA Today, Al Jazeera, English and more. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Vikas Raval, professor of agricultural economics at Jawaharlal Nehru University. Professor Raval, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.